Bronze and Hazel by Nick Petru. When Robert was born, they said I could never mistake him for another baby because he had my eyes, Bronze and Hazel. But I can't see them now. I'm not sure I recognize my baby. What I do recognize is his smell, lemon disinfectant. I left Robert's room almost exactly how it had been. My husband, Julian, said it was an invitation, unlocking the door for grief. He said we were young enough to start again, to move on. I slept on the carpet in Robert's room at night and often during the day as well. Plastic glow-in-the-dark stars made a galaxy on the ceiling. Trading card albums and comics stood in piles on his desk. His ruined school bag sat on his chair. Threads of maroon fabric hung from it like cobwebs. I let the dust get as thick as icing. The only thing I really changed was his bed. I made it with fresh sheets, so it was nice for him when he got home. That's when I started smelling him. Well, at least, how he had smelt when machines inflated his little lungs in the hospital. I woke on the floor in his room. I wasn't sure if it was night or day. It was as though the world were grayscale. Pale light shone in through the cracks in the curtains behind me. The lemon disinfectant might as well have been in a bucket under my nose. It burned tunnels through my brain, dislodging painful memories. Robert's presence was strong, like I was waiting for him to answer some question of mine. In the light which fell upon his wardrobe door, there was a shadow. A head upon a slender body. I inhaled like I'd been held underwater until that point, my skin pulled tight over my spine. I turned, but there was no one behind me. Yet Robert's bed had been slept in. When I told Julian what happened, he twisted arms to get me on meds. I pretended to swallow the tablets, hiding them in Robert's desk drawer until I woke to divorce papers and one less car in the garage. I think it was when he walked in on me in the bath, candle and blow dryer on the bath caddy, that Julian made his decision. After a walk in the rain, I'd been blow drying my hair in the bathroom when I felt Robert's presence again, like I just told him to stop grumbling and brush his teeth. But what he had said had nothing to do with that. With the blow dryer on, I could almost have pretended I didn't hear him, but my baby had said, "It's too bright, Mum." And he had dashed past me and hidden behind a towel on the towel rack. This time, I didn't gasp. I turned the blow dryer off and stared at the towel in the mirror. There was a shape beneath it. A head. Shoulders and no feet. "Baby?" I said. "Is that you?" "It hurts," he said. "The light." My motherly instincts kicked in and I was at the switch outside the bathroom door in a second. Closing the door behind me, the bathroom was almost pitch black. Robert's presence grew, clearing the humidity from the air. I felt around on the bathroom counter until I found the candle and a lighter. "What about a candle, baby? Will a candle be too bright?" "No," he said. So I lit it. The towel had fallen straight. I moved the candle from corner to corner in the mirror. I was afraid that if I looked at Robert directly, he would disappear. When I moved the candle to the top left corner of the mirror, I saw a shadow standing in the corner by the bathroom door. I choked on my tears and snot. "I knew you'd come back, baby. Tell Mummy how to help you. What can she do to make you stay?" "I'm cold," he said. But his shadow didn't move. "Have a bath with me, Mummy." So I ran the tap. I added bubble bath and I set up the caddy. After testing the water with my foot, I took off my robe and got in. Robert was still in the corner by the door. The water's nice, I said. Come on now. Robert's shadow thinned, but didn't seem to come any closer. When I turned to face the candle, I saw his shadow thicken into existence at the opposite end of the bath. A mask of bubbles clung to his face. The water level hadn't changed, but it was getting colder. I miss you, Mummy, he said. But I know how you can find me. How, baby? His bubble-covered face turned towards the counter, nodded at the blow-dryer, and then turned back to me. The blow-dryer was in my hand before I knew what I was doing. Startled, I set it down on the caddy, and that's when Julian came in and yanked out the cord. If anything, I felt less lonely since my husband left. Robert has spread throughout the house. His shadow is heavy, tall. He's standing in the back corner of his bed, neck bent against the ceiling. I'm at his desk, picking tablets out of the drawer, building a pile in my other hand. When my hand is full, I sit on the edge of his bed and take the tablets, two at a time. The plastic stars above my head start to churn. The galaxy smells like lemon disinfectant. I lay back. Robert folds upon himself, down out of the corner. He is lying at my side now, pale light upon his face. But his eyes aren't bronze and hazel. There aren't eyes there at all, only scooped out shadow. I don't recognize my baby. The end. Hello, kids. Welcome to Spinning Yarns with Nick and Patty, a podcast created by my writing partner, Nick Petru, and I, Patrick McCarthy, where we'll be immersing ourselves in the world of the written words and attempting to be as entertaining and as smart-ass as possible. Before we proceed, we'd like to acknowledge that this little production we've got going on is being held on Aboriginal land, and we recognise the strength, resilience, and capacity of Noongar people in this land. Nick, how are you?
Swell.
Great. Nice, man. Cheers, yeah. Bro.
Cheers, man.
It's 9 a.m. We're pissed as fuck. And we're really excited to start this podcast. So we are aspiring writers, and we have started this podcast purely because it's a, I don't know, it will keep us being, I guess, keep us creatively proficient, keep us active. And it's a way for us to reflect on our own writing, allow others to do so as well, and to maybe open other people up to what we've written and what we consider great writing and great stories. And we're pretty excited about it. It's been,
yeah,
been pretty fun so far.
Big part of it is trying to build a community as well. Mm. Like, ideally, we'll have people submit their own stories and potentially even essays and stuff to the podcast. And we'd like it to grow online and as well as in Perth where we live.
Mm.
That'd be great. Just to bring creatives together, like especially now with the pandemic and stuff, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone's so isolated.
And Perth's such a small place too. Like, I feel like I don't know many people who are maybe as immersed in this sort of obsession as you are, as we are, you know?
Yeah.
So this will be a nice way to prove that idea wrong.
You know? Out there.
Yeah, for sure.
It's just bringing them together because everybody's got this notion that, like, you know, in Perth, nothing happens here. But, you know, we've got to...
Yeah.
What, like a few million people here or whatever, like a few of them are going to be creating stuff at least.
At least 8 or 9.
Yeah.
Like at least some people somewhere. We want to meet them, you know, we'd like to get in touch with people and as you said, sort of bolster a community really, hey.
And not even just like writers and stuff, you know, we could have musicians come in. It could be anybody, you know.
Please, anyone.
You could create art exclusively with papier-mâché.
Yeah. Using only
like
your penis.
We'd like to hear about it.
Papier penis mâché.
Oh.
But if that's your thing, if that's how you tell stories, if that's how you express yourself, then We're interested.
I've seen someone paint with his dick before.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How was it?
It's really weird, hey?
Man, I wouldn't have thought that. I would have thought it would be the most ordinary thing to witness in the whole world. What colour was the painting?
Oh, he used a bit of blue and then he washed it off and used a different colour. It was so bad.
Dude. Shit, so you had a little paint cock bath. So anyway, what were we doing? The podcast?
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, yes, this is a little creative venture for us, a little creative endeavour. And we're really excited about it. It's just a lot of fun for us, to be honest. We love to write. We love to express ourselves. We love to chat a load of shite. So this will allow us to do so. And we hope you enjoy it anyway. So the story we read at the outset of this episode 1 of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Paddy, was a short story called Bronze and Hazel, which was written by my friend here, Nick Petrou.
Yep.
So yeah, like, man, like, just like, why'd you do that? Like, it was, poof, great Christ almighty. What was going on?
I wrote it a while back, actually. It's probably been about 6 months now. So I'm almost a blank slate now, but I remember much of it came from this fucked up dream I had when I was a little kid. You know, the bath scene?
Yeah.
So it kind of evolved from this, I would say probably a nightmare, actually, where...
Yeah, it's creepy, dude.
I, as a kid, walked into the bathroom at my old house in Balcatta, and my mum was in the bath in a pool of blood, like all the bath water was red, and she like beckoned me forward to come into the bath. And I think I woke up at that point.
That's fucking blood curdling, dude.
I know. It was really gross. But, you know, actually, you told me this. You said, write what you know. Start channeling some of your real life experience, some of your real life emotion, especially the horror, into your stories, and it's just going to be better. Yeah. And since I've done that, my writing has definitely improved.
For sure, yeah. People will usually misinterpret that advice as well, like write what you know, or write from your own life. You know, like, that's like famous advice. It's not just like, you know, not something I've invented.
Man, no, it wasn't me. You made that up.
No, it wasn't actually me. Unfortunately, it was actually someone way, well, I mean, not as good as me, but it was way earlier than me. But yeah, it's just essentially, you know, even if it's not an actual specific event in your life, it can be rooted in like any idea you've had or feeling you've had or a nightmare or fantasy or some sort of delusion. Yeah. And as long as it's true to your experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, like, it always makes the rawest, the best writing, for sure.
And you can stretch it out, you know, you take just like a feeling, like the memory of a feeling from a dream.
Yeah.
From your childhood. Just and extrapolate it out into something. Okay, yeah, exactly. Like, you don't have to write about like your own boring ass life. You know, that's not what that little adage means or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's how you would, that's, you know, how people can create fantastic, I don't know, stories about gangsters or monsters or adventure stories in like high fantasy worlds. Like, they don't have to be, you know, like, as long as they're rooted in some sort of truth about the human condition or especially the author's experience, then yeah, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Done. So, did you want it to be better than it was?
Definitely.
No, also, no, it was great.
I do feel that there were some sections of it where, like, the phrasing and the language was a little weak, where it could have been a little bit more concise. And I think if I was to edit that story now, I could, you know, fix that up in, like, an hour or so. And it would be a fair bit stronger, but I think...
It's a good little nugget, you know? It's not too long. It's, like, it tells a succinct, creepy little horror story already, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're probably right. Like, it would be a breeze to move through
just
and...
Just a little tightening.
Tweak, you know what I mean? Yeah, for sure, yeah. And it's always satisfying doing that.
Did you have any critiques about it yourself, or?
To be honest, actually, like, you, like, when I, especially when I was reading out, like, at the outset of this episode, like, I really enjoyed that. It was great to read out, like, especially the, I don't know, when it starts to become quite creepy, and the, I loved the disassociation of the mother, especially at the outset. Like, it's very, very clear that she's just gone through some shit, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, honestly, I thought it was great. Like, I thought all your language choices were simple and pared back, and the choices you did make were very emphatic, like the smell associated with his death, like in the hospital, I presume, his son, the lemon disinfectant. Like, it's just such a strange phrase, but it was really, like that.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, but like, it's as the author, you hearing it back and reading it over, like you'd probably, you know, it's like me, man. I've noticed fucking a million things every like poem I write.
Yeah,
I'm like, dude,
yeah.
I could have done that way better. Or what's that syllable doing there? What the fuck, you know? But no, honestly, I really enjoyed it.
I was going to say one thing that I might have done a little differently was the tense change in that story. Although it kind of is bookended by like present tense. And you know, like at the beginning, there's present tense, it changes to past tense. She's like recapping what happened and then it returns to present tense. I might've done that a little bit differently. I still don't think it was terrible, but you know, now going forward, I haven't written anything where the tense changes at all.
It's quite difficult to handle. Hey, like I didn't realize until I was at uni and writing stories, and my tutors would get back to me and say, like, you're changing tense all over the place on that subject. And I didn't have any handle on it. I was like, what the fuck are you even talking about? Like,
what is tense?
Yeah. What do you mean? But yeah, that's really important. And it lends like a consistency to the story. It kind of makes it very confusing when you just jump about like that. I thought yours was pretty seamless, though, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Well, I did keep it at the beginning and the end only. But for sure. Like, I just haven't done that since. But yeah, no, I'm pretty happy with that one.
Yeah, cool, man. Also, I will let you know, like, you know, this is episode one. We're going to be doing this every episode. Like, we're going to be reading out pieces we've both written, you know, and we're going to be giving them a little critique, a little breakdown. But we're not going to blow smoke up each other's ass. Like, if we don't like them and we have things we want to pick out, we are going to do so. I just really love Nick and everything he does, and I want to be fair, you know?
Nice, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
That's okay, you're welcome, man.
When someone says they love you and you just say thanks back.
Yeah. Cheers. Stories We Love, a segment where we'll take the time to geek out and fawn over a story, be it a novel, game, movie, song, play, poem, or whatever else, and a specific characteristic that to us makes that story great. In this first section, we're going to talk about a video game called Bloodborne, released in 2015, a horror masterpiece. Whereas some video game tales are overtly in your face, crystal clear in motive and intention, and make no mistake, we love those ones too, Bloodborne takes a much more fragmented, mysterious approach to telling its story. Bloodborne never beats you over the head with its narrative and leaves much of its plot up to the player's imagination, preferring instead to wield understatement and mystery to emphasize its horror and the player's fear of the unknown. Crucial plot points, characters, events, and the lore of the world are often laced into the story through very subtle means. Item descriptions, architectural features, creature designs, even the music and the sound design. There is no hand-holding, no arrows showing you the way to go, no in-game parental figure to support you when things get tough, no map or guide. Cutscenes that push the plot forward are rare and cryptic as fuck when they do show. In contrast to admittedly brilliant games like the Uncharted series or The Last of Us, in which every moment and line of dialogue drives the plot forward, at times seeming more like movies interspersed with gaming segments, Bloodborne confidently doesn't give a shit about any of that. The most blatant storytelling Bloodborne does is stage major confrontations between the player and other characters in the form of boss battles. But even then, some of the most integral characters and greatest sequences are hidden away by the game developers and require extra work on the player's part in order to experience them. Most players, in fact, will finish the game and never see all that it has to offer. Now, the game begins as a gothic horror, rife with ghostly fog, sharp church spires, and classic monsters such as ravens, rats, deranged villagers, and horrible werewolves, but slowly and surely morphs into something much more Lovecraftian in nature as it goes. Initially, the scourge of horrible beasties your character battles in the streets of Yharnam appear to be all one needs to worry about, until one particularly terrible revelation. All of the monsters you're slaying were once human, transformed after consuming the blood of a horrendous, otherworldly creature named Ebriatus. A tentacled monstrosity originating from space and named a Daughter of the Cosmos, the leaders of the city of Yharnam trapped the ghastly yet innocent Ebriatus in a cavernous chamber beneath the upper cathedral ward, an area of the city completely concealed from all but the most obsessive of players. It is there they extracted her blood for its magical properties, doled it out to the public as some sort of medicinal tonic, which, as aforementioned, turned the citizens into beastly things. Now, if all of this sounds utterly insane, that's because it is. Not only is every artist the most gobsmacking character and creature design in a horror game full of them, she is the catalyst for the entire plot and chain of events. That the developer From Software and auteur frontman Hidetaka Miyazaki had the gall to hide their own narrative in order to inspire a hunt for those hungry for it is one of the many reasons why we adore Bloodborne. It truly is a horror and storytelling masterpiece. Kookaburras by Patrick McCarthy. Kookaburras dances too outside my room in the endless blue, and I gaze back at all the times I've done the same. Three times I've been in love so deep, making promises I could never keep, while dreaming of giving each of them my last name. I'd find someone, become lost in lust, and soon being with them is all I'd trust, and our attraction then would cease to be a game. The romantic inside me built everything up, but my reality could never live up to how it was in my head, and down it would go in flame. I'd never mean to end things so, but somehow I'd lose my will to grow, to change, to love, for which I'll always be ashamed. The last one was sheer agony. I'll never find another like she, and for throwing it away, I have only myself to blame. But, perhaps, not all is lost. I still have me, and it's no great cost to know who I am and craft a future at which to aim. Maybe it's best they ended so, because now I have a chance to grow, to change, to love, with a joy I've never been able to claim. Kookaburras dances too outside my room in the endless blue, and I look forward to a time when I can happily do the same. Thanks.
That was lovely, Patrick.
Thank you, Nick.
Why'd you write it?
I wanted to, I guess, like, examine why, or what was going through my mind and heart when I ended a 3-year long, you know, like a long-term relationship with like an ex that, you know, that was, she was beloved to me. And it just struck a chord with me as to like why I was unhappy, and this poem was, I guess, my way of delving into those feelings and, you know, figuring out how I was supposed to feel and why I was feeling a certain way and why I didn't see any future in our relationship, and also called to mind previous long-term monogamous relationships I've had that I've also ended, and they're all ending for the same reasons. You know, it's because I find it difficult to grow and to flourish, and I also have, you know, selfish elements, and I have a hard time. I find it too easy to stagnate. So yeah, so this was my way of, I guess, exploring those feelings and figuring out for myself how to move forward.
Do you use poetry for that purpose often?
Yeah. I figured I'd do. I didn't realize I did. Like, I thought I was doing them for like for fun or just like to, you know, just to fucking show off or whatever the hell. But like, it actually serves a real important purpose in my life currently. Like, certain things I feel about, I don't know, my love life or the people I've lost or even just, you know, strange, surreal things like having a fucking wicked night out. Sometimes it's great to like write a poem, construct rhymes and have some sort of, tell some sort of story about it in order to figure out how you felt about it and reflect upon the experience, you know. And it's been really nice.
Yeah, no, nice. I, know very little about like poetry and poetic form and all that. And I was just wondering, like, did you adhere to any sort of like structure when you wrote that poem? Did you have that in mind?
So I like, I get quite obsessed with syllable counts, you know, like how I get really strict. I like setting strict limitations on how many syllables will be in every line and then, you know, in every refrain at the end of a stanza. I like keeping that consistent so there's like a musical flow. I also love rhymes. Like, I love lyricism. I know a lot of friends in the past and even now perform and get involved in like slam poetry, which I've been asked to do, but I feel like a lot of it's like really unfocused and unprepared. And it's kind of like just a bit of, a lot of times just like gobbledygook, like thematic, story-wise, like narrative gobbledygook. Like people are just kind of saying things and rhyming them for no real reason. And I quite like having a bit of intent, you know, going out with a specific idea, a specific theme, a specific emotion I want to explore and navigate through, and then use strict syllabic structure and rhymes to, I guess, like really evoke what I'm trying to say, and do it in like a very specific kind of artful way. And like I'm, you know, trying to work really hard on them, and then the magic of that is that once they come out, like they sound like you didn't work on them at all, which is great.
Like you were saying that people wanted you to come try out slam poetry. They would have watched you perform, right? Like, tell us a little bit about that. What do you do on the stage?
Well, I've been asked to perform in Fremantle at this place called the Aardvark, which is like an artist cellar down below the Norfolk Hotel, by a friend of mine, Yuna, who I work with at Clancy's. And she asked me because I took the piss out of one of my colleagues with like an impromptu limerick on the spot when he's been a bit of a moody cunt. But yeah, so I've been performing there since like November. And, you know, I started out with like 10 minutes, then they bumped me up to 15 minutes, and now I've got half an hour. And it's great. It's just like a stand-up act that I get all to myself, and it's all my own writing and all my own little interludes. And it's lovely seeing friends and fam there, and like it feels good to get the support. And also it feels great just to perform and be doing something active, and I really enjoy it.
Well, we'll probably hear more of your poems as we go along. I think they'll probably be a pretty staple of the podcast.
Yeah, man, yeah. If everyone's into them and everyone's interested, you know, I know poetry is like the aforementioned video game, Bloodborne. Like, it, you know, it can be a little bit niche in interest, but like, you know, when if it hits the sweet spot, you know, people are going to be interested, so...
Yeah, and they can always just skip past it.
Yeah, and they can also just skip past it. They don't fucking give a shit. which they, I imagine they'll do, you know?
Cunt again.
Oh, poems, yum.
Patrick and his feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, all right. So that was episode one of our podcast, Spinning Yarns with Nick and Patty. It was really fun, actually. I imagine everyone had a lovely time.
I didn't have a good time.
Neither. we had a really nice time recording it. We're going to keep doing these like every, I don't know, week, couple weeks. We're going to just keep working hard on it. Keep providing pieces that we've written, you know, stories and poems, etc. Keep talking about stories that we're fascinated by, that we're in love with. Yeah, I mean, roll on episode two, I guess.
Yeah, I think we'll probably aim at least every fortnight to release an episode for now, but ideally we want to be pumping one out every week.
Pumping.
Yeah. No, it was a good time, and thank you for listening.
Whoever was listening, if there was anyone.
Probably just my mom.
Probably just my mom. Probably just our moms and us. I'm thinking that at the end of every episode we'll say a little bye, but we're also going to end with a little quote. You know, just to be really dainty. So this is an excerpt from the Papyrus Lansing, right? Which is like an ancient Egyptian text written circa 18th century BC, right? I know the man, Nick's asleep. And essentially it advocates for the life of the writer. At this time, like scribes were just starting as a profession. They were being heralded by the pharaoh, who was like, what was his name? Sunrisit III. And he was... you know, training new scribes in the new profession and educating them in rising literary forms such as poetry, philosophy, and narrative. And it's this little excerpt. And the quote is, "Happy is the heart of him who writes. He is young each day." ¶¶